Michael Wachowski, Reel 6. Mm. So you decided the ACAC was going to be for you.
Yes.
Which unit did you join?
Well, so we joined the 1st Anti-Aircraft Artillery, which was part of what we learned gradually, because you always learned everything gradually and afterwards. You knew nothing in the beginning. It was in February 1942, the British government passed an acceptance of forming a 1st Polish Armoured Division in February 1942. And that division was in Scotland, the formation of the 1st Polish Armoured Division. So I joined the 1st Anti-Aircraft Regiment of the 1st Polish Armoured Division. And we were sent to a lovely seaside resort in Scotland, obviously, Gullin, or Gillane, the Scots used to call it, which was about 20 miles east of Edinburgh.
How do you spell that?
Gullin is G-U-L-L-A-N-E, Gullin. And we occupied all the hotels in that holiday resort, which what a contrast. I mean, after the Soviet Union, you see all these things, it's contrast all the time. And the proper bashing started. And we were very, very quickly pushed in our proper place with regard to training. And it started, there was no really in the beginning emphasis on too much on saluting and other silly things that normally in peacetime the soldier has to follow up.
So what sort of training were you doing? You were doing square bashing?
Square bashing in the beginning, but at the same time straight away training with our 40mm Bofors guns. So we started off only a few weeks, and then our group, we were sent in Gullin, they formed a cadet officer's school. So we were very proud boys, but the training was very severe and very cruel at times.
How was it cruel?
Well, it was cruel that there was no mercy upon, shall we say, physical survival. You had to be quite fit to survive the whole training. And the actual course which we followed up, you see, you had also theory as well, apart from bashing and training, how to operate these anti-aircraft guns and anti-tank training as well we had. And
what sort of things did you do in the anti-tank training?
Well, anti-tank, well, later on we used to fire at artificial tanks running on the railings, you see. Well, we had lots of training, and particularly with my cadet officer's school, you see, we had subjects like geometry, trigonometry, topography, ballistics, and then, of course, reconnaissance of our aircraft, enemy aircraft, German and Japanese even, and also the tanks as well.
So, who was doing the training? Was it all Polish officers?
Oh, yes, Polish officers. Because, you see, what happened after the collapse of Poland, remember that many Poles, in fact, the elitist part of the Polish army, with miraculous sort of achievements, they landed in France. And they formed a couple of Polish divisions in France, and Polish Air Force in France, and they fought in France, only to face the collapse of France. And from France, they all, through Dunkirk and other ports, landed in Britain. So, and the Polish government was formed first in Paris. General Sikorsky became Prime Minister and the CNC of the Polish Armed Forces. And it was all transferred to London. So in London, in 1940, there was already a Polish government in exile. There was famous Polish Air Force that was fighting during the Battle of Britain and secured a tremendous legend about it. And so the formation, you see, we had already personnel very well trained. And we had officers from the old Polish army who were training us at the cadet officer school. And we enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it tremendously, and the training was superb. And we were periodically with the regiment, but separately always the cadet officer school, because we were a little bit prouder, you know, being cadet officers. We dressed differently too. And we were sent regularly to Clacton-on-Sea for fire practicing. And we occupied usually with other Canadian regiments as well, and some British regiments, the Butlin's holiday camp in Clacton-on-Sea. And what was interesting, that we didn't see any civilians there. They were all evacuated. The only civilian population were, women's service. There were, you could see the Wrens and the WAFs and the ATS, and later on I mentioned the Land Armour girls. And departing for a moment from military affairs, we soon established, or at least I established in my head, a certain table of approachability of the women's services. And the most stuck up were Wrens, they were unapproachable really. Next were WAFs, they were a little bit all right. ATS were quite eligible. And the most commendable and were the Land Army girls. Well, that was my establishment of the approaches to the feminine side of the military establishment of Clacton-on-Sea. We used to practice all the time firing at bags carried by an aircraft. And on one occasion, I remember how our boys shot down the aircraft, and it was a Canadian pilot. You can just imagine when he came down to us, the way he was swearing at the poles and so on. But it was part of training. But as cadet officer school, we were also sent as for proper firing, because the Germans were perpetually flying over Clacton and Sea towards London. And we were placed with, I remember, my gun crew as cadet officers on a Mortello tower just outside Clacton-on-Sea. And to our greatest achievement as cadet officers, you see, we shot down Junkers 88, which to us was absolutely an incredible experience. And when we came ashore, you know, from the tower, and we were greeted so wonderfully by the British boys, who actually had heavier anti-aircraft artillery guns on the shore, and they were absolutely delighted too. This Junkers 88, I always remember watching it coming down, and that also was very fascinating to see during the night, the searchlights following German aircraft and firing, and on occasions you could see really the aircraft was hit and was coming down in flames, or you could see pilots parachuted coming down as well. So there was a hell of a lot of happening in Clacton-on-Sea.
Your role as an officer, you would...
Pardon?
In your role, you were a cadet officer.
Cadet officer.
So were you working in a team on the
aircraft? Oh, yes, team. Oh, yes. Well, the gun had a team.
Yes.
There was eight of us. There were eight of us. And you see, you were actually rotating being in charge. You weren't bossing around your friends. They wouldn't accept that anyway. But it was quite an experience. Then we used to always go back to Gallen, and again we returned. I remember later in almost 1944, we were placed properly as a cadet officer's school still in Holland on Sea. But the purpose of it was simply as defense against aircraft flying towards London. So we were there, I remember we had nearby those Landarmer girls. You see, they were very nice girls and very acceptable companions. And that was our sort of experience of being involved in the defence of approaches to London.
What contact did you have with the British civilians?
Well, you didn't see any civilians, to be quite honest. There were hardly any civilians in our movements. In Clacton and Sea and in Holland and Sea, only Landarmer girls we saw. But you see, you were so engaged within the framework of your guns that there was no time to roam around looking for civilians, and we didn't see many of them at all.
Did you feel welcome in Britain?
Extremely welcome, extremely. As a matter of fact, the attitude, as I often remarked upon it from the perspective of the modern days, that it was a different England of Britain. It was a different nation, as a matter of fact, in comparison, no disrespect to the modern generation, you see, of so-called the Brits, you see, an entirely different. It was, the people were different human beings, and the hospitality everywhere was tremendous, tremendous. And they did have tremendous respect for us as soldiers, and particularly...
Sorry.
No, you... Yeah.
I was going to say, did you have any idea of what was going on in Poland?
Not really. No, the only thing we had, you see, was the first in 1943 was a shocking experience which we had to bear. Was the catastrophe at Gibraltar and General Sikorsky. And it created a certain confusion in the prevalent news which circulated among our troops, because it was suggested that it was done by the British intelligence, then by the Soviet intelligence, and then by the Polish opponents of Sikorsky. But ultimately, we never found an answer to it, and in fact, there is no answer to it until now. Nobody has got proper answer to Sikorsky's case.
Were you deeply affected by that yourself?
Well, we were disturbed by it, I must admit. We felt that it was something funny going on, that this catastrophe happened the way it happened, and we didn't really like it very much. Because he was a superb commander. And I should have mentioned probably in our training in Gallen and so on, we had a visit of King George VI and the Queen. Oh, yes, she used to visit Polish troops and Polish Air Force, particularly the Queen Mother, she is now established. But King George VI regularly visited Polish troops with the Queen Elizabeth and the Polish Air Force particularly, and they visited us in Scotland a few times too. So this sort of news was not... But then it was a reflection upon the fluctuating relationship between Soviet Union and Poland. And then, of course, Katyn came as well, which again, as a matter of fact, it's only recently that the Foreign Office published proper documentation about Katyn, because one realized the difficulties that the Alliance had with regard to Katyn and the Soviet Union. To preserve the Alliance during the last war, it was absolutely essential to make sacrifices, and Poland was again sacrificed, and the Foreign Office had to appease Stalin, who insisted that Katyn was conducted by the Germans. But we all knew it was the NKVD that really executed 4,500 Polish officers. And that was the reason why Stalin broke off diplomatic relationship with the Polish government in exile because of Katyn, because Sikorsky wanted an independent Red Cross inquiry about it. Of course, the Russians wouldn't have it. And they broke off the relationship, and at the same time, as we learned all after the war, Stalin insisted in contact with Churchill to all the time classify us as sort of traitors to Poland, and never accepted our contribution in the West as far as Polish contribution was concerned. The Soviet-Polish relationship were not very happy, but then again, the whole relationship historically was never happy either. So we go back to Gallen and our training, and eventually there were all sorts of episodes about training that it's quite severe, as a matter of fact, because some boys used to faint sometimes when we were marching, because we had also training, as a matter of fact, with the landing crafts and
all that
we had to do. And
what
it was
training you up for then?
Well, they were training us to be officers, basically, to be officers and to have sort of a command of the weaponry that we had, which we had, of course, our 40-millimeter Bofors guns, and that we had all the Stens and all Brands and all the Piads. That's all we had. And we had to be trained properly to the extent that I remember it was not only myself, but like every cadet, we still classified ourselves as cadet officers, you see, that I could take this Bofors guns at night into pieces and put it back again by simple feel of the fingers. And he was so well trained, and they did train us very well. Some boys, when we had marches with full equipment on your back, you loaded sometimes with bricks, you know, and up hills in Scotland, as you can imagine, there are plenty of hills for climbing up. Some boys used to faint, and I remember the commanding officer shouting, "Don't you dare, your job is to march forward. Never mind that he faints or dies, you go forward." We thought it was very cruel at times, but that's it. That's the proper training. So then I remember we went on, we had maneuvers, the whole division. I remember we had maneuvers, and we had also the Canadians, because eventually, as we learned later on, you see, the setup was there was the 21st Army Group, which consisted of the 2nd British Army and the 1st Canadian Army. And our 1st Polish Armored Division was part of the 1st Canadian Army, which consisted of three Canadian divisions, and the 51st Highland Division and Polish 1st Armored. And then there was a small contingent of the Czechs as well. Now, when we had maneuvers, I remember I came across some of the Czechs because we could easily understand the language. And it was a joke which spread later on, that when we asked Czechs, "Well, how do you feel about fighting?" and so on, he said, "Well, we'll certainly fight, but we'll never forgive the Brits, you know, Chamberlain, the debacle about, you know, this period when Chamberlain came back with this letter, you know, our secured peace, our life and all that, and when Czechoslovakia was really sacrificed. And one Czech said to me, I remember that, he said, well, I'm not going to fight for the British Marmalade. You see, that was his remark, you know, after what the British did to us. You see.
What did you think of the Czechs as soldiers?
Well, they were just dressed up like us. We were all in battle dresses. We all looked alike, like little monkeys, you know, ready for slaughter anyway. But, they were just sort of different nationality. But as far as the military presentation was concerned, we were all alike, really. All the same equipment, same weaponry, and then so on.
Did you have much contact with the Canadians?
Oh, well, in action later on, very much, but not before we went to Normandy, no. Because there were three or four divisions themselves, they were training as well. So we had those maneuvers, exercises, and eventually. You see, we were moved, my division, believe it or not, to Yorkshire, and my regiment was in Scarborough. But the idea was to give you a sort of a little break and entertainment and a bit of respite before we were sent to Normandy. So we occupied some of the hotels in Scarborough. She used to go every night to Royal Hotel, dancing and so on. There were all sorts of experiences one had with the population was extremely kind all the time. But we were still all the training and exercising and so on. On one occasion, I remember we had our guns on the beaches in Scarborough and two princesses came to visit Scarborough. Yes, and we all were performing our sort of ability to protect them and protect everybody and so on, like little boys.
What did you think of the princesses?
Well, they were very attractive, you see. And you see, as a soldier, you do appreciate good-looking girls, I'm afraid, because it's a natural instinct of a soldier. Is appreciation of women and appreciation of a little drink, really, because you always had the feeling that sooner or later it may all end. So we had...
Did you do a lot of drinking? Was drink a big part of your social life?
Well, you couldn't afford it, first of all, and we couldn't drink very much. No, we were not allowed to drink as much as during the cadet officer school. I don't think I remember ever drinking at all. We were only paid because we were basically privates at the school. And I think that our pay was 7 shillings and 6 pence per week, you see. You know? And we had to buy our own toothpaste, boot polish, and there wasn't a margin allowing you to spend on alcohol. Or women, for that matter. But... anyway, we had exercises again. My regiment was in Scarborough, and eventually I remember everything was dead silenced. The landing took place in Normandy.
We were in Scarborough,
and we could sort of, the feeling was sort of a shiver in the whole system.
Had it been mentioned to you, an invasion?
The preparation was mentioned.
What you were going to do.
But never, never any detail of it. Never any detail on what was going on. But it was in our imagination that the whole preparation was going on. But again, as a little boy, to me, it was all a mystery, really. But the first element, apart from the order came silencing all radios and everything, you see, and we saw first convoys, even from Yorkshire along the coast in Scarborough, all going south, you see.
That was before Before D-Day.
Before D-Day. So we felt, well, there's something happening, obviously. Then we stayed in Scarborough. We had an enjoyable time. It was a wonderful town. I even met some young ladies, as a matter of fact. Used to go dancing, and I couldn't dance. I used to step on their poor feet and apologize, blaming the overcrowded stage, you see, which of course not right. I always remember there was one lady, Viera was her name, she actually sort of took care of me. She was married on holiday, and she started teaching me dancing and so on, which I was grateful. I also met a charming young lady, Brenda from York. She was on holiday, a very nice young lady, and we developed sort of great friendship, believe it or not. When we left and we went to Normandy, she used to write to me, and she used to send me chocolate and cigarettes sometimes. And right through the campaign, she was the only soul that used to write to me. And it developed into a really love affair in the end, although our relationship was absolutely innocent. As I was joking with her in York, when I visited her, that when I kissed her, she ran back home and said that she was pregnant. You see, the innocence was still prevalent in those days.
Because, of course, you had no contact with your family. None
whatsoever. You see, I left my sister and two brothers in Russia, in the Soviet Union. So, eventually, all these pleasures disappeared, and we started at night, I think, the whole division moving south.
Michael Wartolski, end of Reel 6.
Not crying.